And we're going to get things started now for artist number two of our show today. I told you this is going to be a great show. We got some great talent with us. Calling in from overseas, transatlantic, Mr. Rick Lee of 10 Years After will be joining us in just a minute. But first, let's play something new from 10 Years After. That's right. You probably thought, yeah, I remember that band from back in the day. Well, they haven't gone anywhere. They've got new music, and this is off Sting of the Tail, and it's a great track that opens it up called Land of the Vandals, and I think we're living in it right now. Rick will join us after this. Land of the Vandals. The newest music from 10 Years After. The album's called A Sting in the Tail, and it's being reissued this month, the deluxe edition. The original version came out around 2017, but definitely pick this up. It's on Deco Entertainment in New Jersey, and we have Rick Lee, drummer of 10 Years After and founding member and still at the helm of this legendary band, joining us live from, I believe you're in England, correct?
I am, Tom. Good to meet you.
good to meet you. And I got to say, I'm really liking this new album. I was unfamiliar with it. And then getting the deluxe edition, I've turned on to this album. It's different than the 10 years after that we knew from the Woodstock era. You guys have definitely evolved, much more blues-based, I would say, which I'm sure has a lot to do with yourself, because you had blues bands for a number of years in between. So
That's correct. I did, yeah. I had a band called The Breakers, which I did with my old friend Ian Ellis, who was in a band called Clouds. Mm-hmm. And they were on the Chrysalis Lust roster in the early days.
Now, I remember...
Along with us.
I was going to say, I remember the Rick Lee Blues Project. Was that before or after the Blues Project?
No, that was much later than The Breakers. The Rick Lee Blues Project then became, and this was not my idea, it became Rick Lee's Natural Born Swingers.
Ooh la la!
that was a friend of mine, Bob Hall, the Boogie Woogie keyboard player. I call him Boogie Woogie Bob. He's probably Britain's finest boogie woogie player.
Okay.
And he and I formed a band, and we did an album called Rick Lee's Natural Born Swingers.
Excellent.
The title of the album was called Put a Record On. We were very proud with that album, but for some reason, I don't know, we couldn't get arrested to do gigs with it. It was really strange. We did one gig in Sweden, and that was the lot.
Now, obviously... I would say, obviously, COVID has got everybody kind of, off track right now. What is, things are starting to open up a little bit here in the States. I don't know how it is over there, but are you leaning towards getting back on the road? Is there anything coming together yet, or is it still too premature?
Well, I talked to our agent in America and our agent in Europe, and they both said to me, really and truly, you're looking at 2022.
Okay.
They don't think, the government in England are saying that they'll have everybody vaccinated, everybody, that is, that will take the vaccine, because they're getting some refusal on that, which is bizarre.
Right.
But they'll get everybody vaccinated by October at the latest. Of course, when you get winter, then all the viruses click in again, because they like the cold weather. Mm-hmm. They don't like the hot weather. So you get flu, you'll get COVID again. There's various versions of COVID now, of course. We've just closed all the borders to stop people coming in with a variant from South Africa or from Brazil with the variants, because we're not sure whether the vaccine, or they're not sure, sorry, that the vaccine will be a defense against those variants.
Right.
So... the scientists are working hard to try and keep up with this, or better still, to stay one
ahead,
one step ahead of the new viruses. But who knows? It's not an easy thing, this.
Right. Well, A Sting in the Tail, as I mentioned in the beginning, originally came out in 2017. So most of this work has been done with the downtime because of COVID. Are you guys able to do anything long distance through virtual studios or anything to work on new songs? Is there any writing going on? Is there any recording, demoing for a forthcoming 10 Years After album?
What do you want me to answer first?
All of the above.
Oh, okay. Taking it roughly in chronological order, the album, I made a deal with a Dutch company that we'd had as distributors for about 10 years, and they've always been very good to us, and they started their own label. So I said, well, why don't we come with you guys? And they were very happy about that, and we have a very nice, it's a 50-50 joint venture deal.
Okay.
And it works really well for us. And we sold a lot of the records in Europe. We do vinyl over there as well. And in America, they just have it. Basically, it was through a distribution company and or import. So I have a very good friend in Philadelphia who's also a DJ, a guy called T. Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
And T and I have been friends since 1967. And he was one of the first guys. He was the first guy. He was over in England in a summer holiday in that period, and he saw the band at the Marquee Club, and he found the first album and the second one, Undead, and brought them back to America and was the first guy to play those on radio. And he's been a fan, and we've been firm friends ever since. And when we were over in 2019 doing the here in the Woodstock 50th Memorial tour, Memorial's wrong. That sounds like Woodstock's dead. It's still very alive.
Anniversary. We'll call it the anniversary.
Thank you. That's what I was. The word I was looking for. Thank God you're there, Tom. T said to me, look, I gave him the album when we played. We play a theatre there called the Sellersville Theatre, and T always comes along and he introduces the band, which is fantastic after all these years. And he said, you know, that album is too good to be just beyond on import and distribution. You need to get it out and let people know about it. He said, I love it. I think it's fantastic. You've got to do something. And it was T that introduced me to Deco.
Okay.
And Deco have been fantastic. They picked up the baton and they're running with it like a fantastic racing machine. The man that's doing the PR, Chip, is wonderful. And I've been doing interviews all this week and last week. In fact, about a week ago, he had me doing 12 10-minute interviews over 2 hours.
Wow. Yeah, I've known Chip since the 80s. So, yeah, he's a hard-working guy, I'll tell you that.
Oh, tell me. This got me working harder than if I'm on stage with the band, you know.
Well, this album, again, for those that that might have purchased it as an import, you've treated us to something special. There's live tracks on here to enhance
That's
it.
Right.
And better booklets and things like that. Tell us about the live recordings. Where were they done at?
Well, about a year following the studio recording, we play around Germany and Austria, Switzerland, Scandinavia, Holland, France, a heck of a lot when we're able to, when we haven't got COVID. We work about, certainly 9 months, maybe 10 months of the year. And we were out playing and we thought, hey, it would be great to record the new set, because we change the set all the time as well. And we were playing in a place called Erfurt, which used to be in the Old East Germany.
Okay.
And it's a wonderful city, and they have a fantastic auditorium there that we always fill. We sell it out every time. So we recorded the set there. And so we then put that album out subsequent to A Sting in the Tail, and that's called Naturally Live. That's probably available on import as well, I would think. But I'm talking to Deco, and hopefully maybe later this year we can make a deal with them to put that one out as well.
Okay.
And on that recording we did I'd Love to Change the World, which is our top 40 hit, as you know, in the 1970s.
Right. And before we say goodbye to you, we are going to play that. But I don't want to get into a long song right now. We have a lot to cover.
Well, this is when you said that we've changed a lot. I mean, in the old days, I don't think there was a 10 years after song that was under 7 minutes long.
That's true. That's true.
And a lot of them were 19 minutes, would you believe? I can't keep from crying sometimes. Started off as a 4-minute song on the first album and ended up on latter albums, Live at the Fillmore East. I think it's 19 minutes on there.
Yeah, you guys did a lot of live albums. You did a lot of live albums over the years.
Well, the band really was a live band, you know. We never quite were as successful with studio albums as we were with live stuff. And I think that's because it was the energy and the you know, we were more like a sort of a jazz band that improvised. We would have a verse at the beginning, then an improvisation, and that could be as long or as short as anybody. It depended on the night.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would finish off with the verse again or whatever it was, or the chorus at the end.
Of course,
you know, we were one of the original jamming bands.
Right. You know? I was just going to say that you guys made your name. You got on the radar at Woodstock by doing Going Home, which was like half an album side.
That's correct. Yeah.
So let's talk about today. 10 years after. Of course, everyone says, oh, 10 years after, Alvin Lee. Alvin's been gone a number of years. You have got an incredible young guitarist, vocalist, Marcus, who is with the band. And it's important to note that along with yourself being an original, Chick Churchill is still with the band, who is a keyboard player. So it's you still got half the original band, and you got a couple of younger guys that are with you now that are winning fans over, old, you know, new fans as well as the old fans. Where did you find Marcus? And tell me a little bit about Colin, who also has quite a pedigree with Spencer, who we just lost, and Peter Green, who we just lost. He's got some chops as well. How did this new lineup come together, and when?
Well, I have to correct you because Colin is actually 6 days older than me.
Oh, okay. He's not a young guy then. He's a seasoned guy, shall we say?
Yes, that's a good phrase. I like that. Yeah. We're Chick, Colin, and me. We're all 75 years old, and thank God we're still doing it, and we're still enjoying doing it. And this, to me, is the best lineup we've ever had since Alvin passed on.
Mm-hmm.
We found. Colin was always going to be my first call if anything happened with Leo. And Leo actually decided to leave. We had a lineup with Leo and a guy called Joe Gooch, who's a phenomenal guitar player. And we did that for about 10 years. And then Joe decided he wanted to do something else. And when Leo went with him. And my first call was always going to be Colin, because we knew Colin as a friend. We used to pass like ships in the night in Europe when he was with Spencer. And I'd known him from before that. He used to do a one man show at one time, and I remember when there was a show in Buxton, Derbyshire, which is near where I live. There's an opera house there, and they have rock concerts as well. And there used to be a fundraiser for Alexis Corner, the Alexis Corner Foundation.
Okay,
and. One of the bands that was first on there was Page and Plant. And I went along to that, and Colin had actually been invited to do his one-man show on that. And so he used to get up and do about half an hour on his own, playing the bass like a guitar. I mean, it's just fantastic what he can do with that and singing songs with it. Just amazing. So because he was a heck of a nice guy as well, he was first on my list.
Okay.
And he said, yeah. I said, actually, he said, Spencer's just folded the band up. So he said, I was wondering what to do next. That would be brilliant. So we got together and we did a rehearsal with another guitarist friend of Chick and mine that we'd worked with before. But for some reason, it didn't work out. He didn't quite have the confidence, I think, that we needed for a front man. You know, it's one hell of a weight taken over from Alvin Lee.
Exactly.
You know, and so Joe Gooch did it admirably, you know. But I found Chick had gone to Australia to see his son. And I had a list as long as my arm of people, guitar players and singers. And I wanted somebody young that could bring in some new energy to the band. So I went down the list, and it was getting shorter and shorter, and I phoned Chick, and I said, I don't know what we're going to do here. I said, Colin's on board, but I can't find a guitarist, so I don't know what to do. And it so happened I was talking to a PR man about a completely different subject, and I just happened to say to him at the end of the conversation, I said, do you happen to know a good young blues guitarist singer, do you? He said, well, I know a good blues singer. He's just been nominated for a blues award in UK. I said, oh, who is it? He said, well, it's a guy called Marcus Bonfanti. I said, well, where do I contact him? He said, well, I don't know. He said, all I've done is I've read about him in the press. So anyway, I searched the internet, couldn't find him. He had a website, but it wasn't actually up and running at that point. But I finally found him through Facebook. And I sent him a message. I said, I don't know whether you'd be interested or not, but we're looking for a singer guitarist to play with 10 years after. Let me know if you'd be interested. So I didn't hear from him for 2 days. And then he came back to me. He said, yes, I'd be very interested. And I said, well, can you send me some kind of demo? I tell a lie, sorry. I said, I'd like to see you. And he said... Well, I'm on tour at the moment. I'm the opening act for a band called The Straits, which was a couple of guys from Dire Straits.
Okay.
And he was playing a theatre. I live up in the north of England. I'm about 50 minutes from Manchester one way and 40 minutes from Sheffield the other. And there's a theatre down in Lichfield, which is not far away. It's quite near to Birmingham. It's only about an hour's drive. And he said, I'm playing art. I said, right, I'll come down and see you. So I went down, I met him. We had a couple of beers before the show. Seemed a very, very nice guy, very affable guy. I went into the theatre, sat there, two ladies sitting next to me. I said, have you seen this before? Have you seen this show or whatever? She said, no. It was about 400 seats, the theatre, and it was packed out.
Okay.
And I said, have you seen this guy, Marcus Bonfanti? She said, oh, who's that? I said, well, he's the opening act. Oh, no, we don't know anything about him. Anyway, lights go down. Marcus comes onto the stage and was walking steadily to the microphone. And he had an acoustic guitar that night. He's tuning the guitar. And I could feel it in the audience that, like, just his stage presence. He hadn't done anything. He'd not spoken. He'd not done anything except tune his guitar as he walked to the mic. And the stage presence was just absolutely phenomenal. And he got to the microphone and he said, hi, my name's Marcus Bonfanti. You've probably never heard of me. I'm going to do you some of my songs. I really hope you like them, and I'll see you again in a few minutes. And with that, he started. And from that moment, the audience was leaping out of the palm of his hand.
Wow.
It was just incredible. I'd never come across anybody with that. I mean, Hendrix had a lot of stage presence, but he'd also had the hype by the time we got to know about him, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Whereas Marcus is there, not known, and he has this amazing presence. And I thought, well, this has got to be the man. So I go and chat with him afterwards, and I told him that I felt good about it. And I said, but there's one thing I need to do. I said, I need to know you can play electric guitar. So he said, well, obviously I can. I said, yeah, but I need to know it. It's the major part of 10 years after.
Right.
And I said, well, it's on my website. I said, yes, I've looked at your website, but there are only little snatches of solos you're doing. I said, I need something in our style. Is it possible you could do a demo of I'm Going Home and Love Like a Man, which are the two sort of key songs with the band? So he said, yeah, I'll do that for you, sure. I said, but you're on tour. He said, don't worry about it. I'll get it sorted. And 2 days later, I had an email with these two songs on, with a complete band. I thought, how the hell has this guy done this? And apparently what he did was, that very night, he managed to find one of the guys who was driving back to London. The tour was going further north. And he jumped in the car or the van or whatever with this guy and went down to London. He called two of his mates. One was a drummer, one was a bass player. They went into the drummer's studio. They recorded I'm Going Home and Love Like a Man and sent them up to me. And then he jumped. He doesn't have a car. He doesn't drive. He travels by public transport. He jumped on the train and went back and joined the tour. And I've got these, and I played them, and I was just totally gobsmacked. And he called me, and he said, what do you think? I said, I want to hire the band, let alone you. So anyway, I sent it down to Chick, and Chick came straight back to me by email. He said, sign him. So that was it. You know, we grabbed him. We went to rehearsal. And the funny part of this, and I didn't know this till quite a bit later when we'd been on the road together a while, I said to Marcus at the second, we had one rehearsal, and Colin said, hey, this guy's brilliant. I love it. I love working with him. You know, so we got another rehearsal together because we had some shows coming up. And I said to Marcus, oh, by the way, we're going to do another rehearsal. He said, yeah, that's cool. I'll be there. I said, can you bring some clothes with you, please? Because we're probably going to do some photographs. And then he told me about 6 months later, we were talking in Europe to somebody. And he said, yeah, he said, you know, Rick never told me I was in the band. He said, all I knew was that I had to bring some clothes for photographs. He said, so I figured I'd got the job.
Forgot to tell him he made the audition, huh? Oh, wow. One of the things that's interesting is that in your book, you wrote a book recently called From Headstocks to Woodstock. Basically, yep. A drummer's journey. You've had such an incredible career. And again, you're an original member. 1965, you co-founded Jaybirds with Chick and Alvin Lee and Leo, and eventually turned into 10 years after. What has kept you and Chick together? And what happened that made 10 years after fall apart in the 70s. You guys had such a strong go of it. And around 74, I want to say, it seemed like it was coming to an end, 74, 75. The one thing...
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, the one thing in your book, you do mention that it was around 1969's Shh album that things started to go a little south because the label wanted to make Alvin into the image of a Jimi Hendrix, a guitar god, so to speak, and it almost like made the band second fiddle, which you guys started as a band, as a unit, as a democracy, so to speak, and all of a sudden Alvin was stepping forward. I never got the impression that that was Alvin's intention. It was more the record label, but 7 years went by before you finally called it a day. So how did that, those interim years, when you guys were doing stuff like Cricklewood Green and Watts and Space and Time, what was the dynamic like within the band? Was it still a brotherhood? That's well, I threw a lot at you there. I'm sorry. I threw a lot at you.
No, it's okay. Don't forget, I'm not a youngster, so I have to work through this slowly. luckily, I still have my memory, touch wood. Going back just quickly, Alvin and Leo were the Jaybirds.
Okay.
And they had a drummer called Dave Quickmire. And Dave actually gave me some lessons and became my mentor. And without me realizing it, he was training me up to take his job because he wanted to get out.
Okay.
So that was the first thing. So I did that. And then we got an audition for a show in London, which we won. And Chick, Alvin had already asked Chick to join the band because at that time, again, back to Spencer Davis, the Hammond organ was becoming quite a part of the modern day sound in 65.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, there was also a great act called the Graham Bond Organization, which had Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker.
Yes.
And Dick Hextall Smith in it. And Graham used to play the Hammond organ and play alto sax at the same time. They were an amazing band. So that was happening in 65. So Alvin thought we needed some keyboards. And he knew Chick. He'd met Chick in a few places socially. And he'd kind of invited him to join the band. But the show hired the three of us. They didn't hire Chick. They wanted the three-piece that they saw. Later, we became the backing band for a band called the Ivy League, who'd have about 3 or 4 top 10 hits in the UK. And we then got Chick in as a road manager. And then after about 6 months or so, he started playing a bit of keyboards with us as well. So we kind of snuck him in there.
Okay.
Then 67, we went down and we did an audition for the Marquee Club, and we got that. And then we carried on, and I think the rest of that is history. The intervening years from... the first thing I think that happened, but we didn't really cotton on to it straight away, or it didn't affect the rest of us, was the editing of the movie of I'm Going Home, which, of the Woodstock movie.
Mm-hmm.
The I'm Going Home was edited by Alvin and our then American manager, D. Anthony. And if you look at that, I mean, the large proportion of that is Alvin, you know,
right.
Which I have no problem with and never did. He was the star of the show. He was what people came to see. But I always maintain, and a lot of other people did too, that 10 years after was the sum of the parts and not any one part. And I think that proved itself later because after we wrapped up in 75, Alvin did various things on his own with different musicians and still kept coming back to us to, I guess, to make it work. I don't know. I don't know what the reasons were.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. Then 1975, and you were right in something you said earlier about it being a brotherhood, which it had been up until from 1970, from the film onwards, it started to go down the tubes a bit. And as you rightly say, we were all pretty upset with the cover of Shush, which was just Alvin's face, and then the rest of the band were on the back. So in a sense, the writing was on the wall of the way things were going.
Mm-hmm.
But 75, Alvin said to me, You're going on wages. I'm the star of the show.
Ooh.
Up to that point, we had it was a cooperative. We had a 4-way split. And plus, Alvin had all of the writing percentages. So And I won't bore you with the details of that. If you want to know them, they are in the book.
Right.
My thoughts on that.
Right.
So 75, he said to me, you're going on wages. I said, no, sorry, I'm not. He said, you are. I'm the star of the show. I said, hey, I'm not disputing the fact you're the star of the show. He said, well, everybody's telling me I should be putting on you guys on wages. You know, you should be my backing band. I said, well, you can go with what everybody else is saying, but I'm not going to do that. And he said, well, what are you going to do then? I said, well, I've set up a publishing company. I'm going to do that, and I'm going to manage a few young artists. I said, don't worry about me. I'll get by. I said, but the thing is that if you wanted to put us on wages, you should have done it way back. Because what you had us do is you had us take the rough with the smooth. Because nobody had a guarantee it was going to work and that we were going to get to where we are. I said, but you expected us to carry that weight with you and take the losses with the profits, you know, which we've done. I said, so you can't now turn around 8 or 9 years after we started happening and say you're going on wages, you know, and I'm taking the bulk of it. I said, I'm not doing it. I'm not interested. Right. I'll take my chances and do what I can do. And that's actually what happened. I was in a sense, I was the first to leave the band.
It's such a shame when friendships and business clash like that. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of what happened with Creedence Clearwater Revival. Everybody paid the dues, and then suddenly when the fame gets there and the money, it's all about the greed factor. And, you know, we get the managers involved and the labels involved, and it's money-driven, and you lose the art and you lose the humanity of it. And I'm glad to hear you stuck to your guns. I really am.
Well, I didn't see any choice, to be honest with you, Tom. But the to be fair, the label wasn't pushing that. They had, excuse me, around about the time of Shush, yeah, you're right, and they were pushing Alvin for all the interviews and stuff. And I remember at that time I said, hey, listen, I have a voice. The press like me. I know a lot of the writers. They're happy to do interviews with me. I want some of the interviews as well. I said, no, I think you should give some to Chick and Leo. Mm-hmm. I can't honestly remember whether they did any or whether they were given any, but I certainly did get some. And it wasn't an ego thing with me. It was a fairness thing.
Right.
I'm a Libran by birth, and Librans like a balance in things. They like fairness, and that comes through with me, I'm afraid. So no. I'm not afraid. I'm pleased.
In 76, when you stepped away, Alvin did 10 years later, as I recall. I remember getting some albums from that. But you, as you mentioned, you got into behind the scenes more of the business side of music. And with, Fast Western Productions, I think, was one of
That's
them.
Right. Yeah.
What brought you out of behind the scenes and back onto the stage again? Had you stopped completely before you started doing the Rick Lee Blues Project and the Natural Born Swingers stuff?
No, I've always played drums.
Okay.
I mean, I can't honestly remember. I probably played with some local bands just to keep my hand in. You know, I always practiced whatever. But I was very keen. I'd signed a very good young writer from Cardiff. His parents are actually Jamaican. But he was born in Cardiff, and he's a fantastic writer. In fact, I'm working on his stuff again right now. And we had a hit record with him, which then had a cover in 1985, I think it was, which went top 10 over here. And then it's been on several compilations albums since. And there are one or two other songs knocking around, not as big as that, but that are in my catalogue. And one of the missions I have at the moment, when I can, if I can find time to get on with it, is to get out and get some covers on these tracks and work them again.
Okay.
It was a different direction. You know, I managed a few artists at the time as well. The problem with managing young artists in the beginning is you need more time than you ever have, and a lot of money to get them to a certain point before, like, a record company will tip in or whatever. In those days, nowadays, you have to get an artist and get them onto social media. The classic example, certainly in this country, is Arctic Monkeys, who built up a huge following on social media before any record company took any notice of them. And I think that's, and I mean YouTube these days, you know, people can post things and become overnight stars now on YouTube.
Right, right.
You know, so, I mean, the competition, I think, is greater, but it's also, there are, if you, again, you need that bit of luck, you know, and if you get the bit of luck, then you'll open up an avenue. One of the tricks, and I've said it before, and I hope people get it, youngsters, if they read my book, is it's one thing getting started. The next thing is staying the course. And the third thing I would recommend is that you have to develop a talent in a way of recognizing opportunities when they present themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of people have opportunities and they don't recognize them, and then they go down the wrong path. So that's the trickiest of the lot, I think.
What made you decide to write the book? Again, for the listeners, it's called From Headstocks to Woodstock. It's a drummer's tale, and it's got all kinds of great stories, behind-the-scenes kind of stuff, some great pictures as well. How long did it take you to do it, and what prompted you to say it's time to do this and set the record straight?
I'm laughing because it took me 10 years, Tom.
Hmm.
There's always a 10 in it somewhere, isn't there?
Yes.
So I started it, and then I kept stopping and starting. And originally I was going to write from the beginning in Mansfield, where I was born, which is in the coal mining area, which is where the headstock spit comes from. That's the winding wheel that dropped the miners into the ground to mine the coal. And it's also the top end of a guitar, of course.
Right.
Where the tuning pegs are.
And see, that's what I thought. That's what I thought the reference was. And I'm thinking, but he's a drummer. Yeah. So, thank you for explaining that.
Well, no, I'm glad you spotted that, because originally the cover of the book had a guitar neck on it as well. And a friend of mine said, but you're not a guitarist, you're a drummer.
Right.
Get rid of that. Yeah, so that's what we did. And I have to compliment a good friend of mine as well, a guy called Neil Haywood, who was a singer with a band called Neil and the Demons in Mansfield when we first started. And we've been friends for years. And he read it and he said, I think you should call it Headstock to Woodstock. So I have to thank him for that title.
Good
title.
It was
originally called From Mansfield. Yeah, it is. It was originally called From Mansfield to Woodstock. And then I realized that if people in America did pick up on it, they'd be thinking Mansfield, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, wouldn't really tell the true story.
See, anyway, I would have added and beyond, because you don't stop at Woodstock. It's a very contemporary book, so it doesn't end at Woodstock.
No, to be honest, it does stop at Woodstock, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, or just, I mean, maybe just a little bit after, but basically it stops at Woodstock. But the idea originally was to write from Mansfield to whatever it was when I was finishing writing it. And then I thought, oh, God, the stuff after Woodstock, a little bit of the story I've just told you about, the breakup of the band and stuff, if I wasn't careful, it would sound like sour grapes,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I didn't want to do that. So I thought, I've got to finish this on a high, and the obvious high was Woodstock. So that's why I took it to there.
Okay.
Anyway, after I've got about 5 years on it, a very good friend of mine in California is an agent for after dinner speakers and college lecturers and those sort of people. And she said, and I had a one-man talk, which I still do, with PowerPoint, you know, clips and video clips and whatever. And I tell the story from Headstock to Woodstock, basically. And she said, could I help you with that? I book people out to do that. I said, well, yeah, that'd be brilliant. She said, well, do you have a book? I said, well, I've got a half a book. So she said, well, get it finished, and then we can start. That's a good way to start. We can move with that, and then we can build the talks on afterwards. So I said, okay, fine. So it then took me another 5 years to get it finished. So finally I did it, you know, and it's a labor of love, really. And it was, I think the story's interesting. It's just something I wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who've read it say that they thoroughly enjoyed it, and that they think I'm a decent writer. So I've achieved my one purpose was if for instance you know who I am and what I've done, if you gave it to a friend of yours who didn't and you'd read it and you said, have a read of that because it's a good read, that's really all I want. to a tooth.
Okay. It's nice to see so many of the bands that rock and roll built its foundation on that maybe weren't the big chart hit guys, but they were the foundation. As I mentioned, bands like Savoy Brown and 10 Years After are still out doing things and putting out some of the best music of their careers. And I've got to say, Sting of the Tail is a solid album from start to finish. Very blues-based.
Thank you very much.
Obviously, the vocals are so much different than say Savoy Brown, but the musicality is there. I love the modern British blues sound. You know, it goes back to the John Mayall days, but I mean, you guys have really brought it up to contemporary sounds. And
thank you.
I'd like to play something before we get to "I Love to Change the World." I'd like to play something to show that. Now, what song would you suggest off of this? We played "Land of the Vandals." I like "Saran Saran," but I also like "Iron Horse." What do you think would be a good one to introduce newer audience members to the new sound?
That's a difficult one because "Saran Saran" is almost a sort of blues pop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the story of that is me falling in love with a girl who was on a TV series in England. And I hasten to add, I was not stalking her.
Okay,
but she had an effect on me. That's for sure. I went to see her in a play, actually. She's a fine, fine actress. And she did a play, and she was in. It was about a two-hour show, and she had to play so many different parts of roles. It was a 300-year-old story. I think it was written by Virginia Woolf, actually.
Wow.
And it's an amazing piece of work, and she did it brilliantly. And a lot of the time, she had to do costume changes. But it was all done in the round in Manchester. In the Royal, what's called the Royal Exchange, which is a fabulous building. And she had to do a costume change on stage. But what they did was they dropped like a tent down from the flies,
mm-hmm.
which would drop over her, and then she could get into the next costume, and then the tent would go back up, and she was somebody totally different. It was incredible. So that was Saran. Iron Whore, it was... Well, how we wrote it, really, Marcus was the hub because he's the chord man. And he has to sing everything, so he's got to make sure that it'll suit what he wants to do vocally.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I wrote about 8 songs or 10 songs together, which obviously some have not been used. And then, so Saran was me and Marcus, basically. And then Colin got together with Marcus, and they wrote similar number of songs, and then Chick and Marcus wrote together as well. So Iron Horse is actually was Colin's basic start, and his dad had worked on the railway.
Okay.
So it was about, you know, it's about the railway. I think Land of the Vandals also was Colin and Marcus. When I say... But at the end of the day, we all ended up as writers. Because I said to Marcus, how are we going to do this? Are we going to take it like the two key writers take, say, 70% or 60%, and then 40% goes to the band because of their input? Mm-hmm. And he said, nah, forget that. He said, let's just split it all 4 ways, you know, which I thought was very magnanimous, really.
The way it should be, the way it used to be before the labels and managers got in, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's play something.
That was one of the problems. Sorry, I beg your pardon.
I was going to say let's play one. Which do you think represents the sound today of this new album? We'll have time for two. We'll close with "I Love to Change the World," but I'd like to play something new.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think which ones we've done that work live. It's "Saran Saran" we don't do at the moment because, as I say, we changed the set a lot. Iron Horse we've not done. I'll tell you what we do. One of Chicks is I can't remember the title. Remind me of the title, Tom. Something Girl.
Oh, Diamond Girl.
Actually, tell a lie. No, we don't do that live. There's another one of Chicks. Sorry, I don't have a list of songs in front of me. Can you remind me?
Yeah, we've got Iron Horse, Miss Constable, Up in Smoke, Retired Hurt, Saran Saran, Stoned Alone, Two Lost Souls, Diamond Girl, Last Night of the Bottle, Guitar Hero, and Silver Spoon Lady.
Last night of the Bottle.
Okay.
That was basically Chick and Marcus's start. And it's also got a nice sort of slide guitar on it.
All right, well, that's what we're going to play. This is new music from 10 years after. Sting of the Tales, the album, Last Night of the Bottle. We'll be back a final time with Rick Lee after this. Last Night of the Bottle, that is new music. 10 years after, Sting of the Tail is the name of the album. It came out originally in 2017. The new version, the updated version with the live tracks and the enhanced booklets and everything else, it is out coming in February. So watch for that. And
Tom, it's been put back 1 month to March 19th.
Oh, it's now March. Okay. Will it be March vinyl? 19th. Will it be vinyl as well as CD and digital?
Not as I know at the moment. I have to speak to the Dutch company because we did the deal together because obviously we're signed with them and okay. They had the original records. They wanted to retain the vinyl rights for America for the time being. Whether they'll be happy to consider that, I need to talk to them next week and see if we can do some kind of get some movement on that.
Well,
I think it would be very, very helpful.
I think it would too. I actually run two vinyl stores, and I know vinyl is back with a vengeance, and we'd love to see new 10 years after on the shelves for sure.
Yeah, well, it's the same in Europe. It's gone crazy. I mean, we take it around with us and sell it at gigs, and it moves like nobody's business. It's incredible.
Wow. How do we keep up?
Just one little...
Yeah, go ahead.
It's the one little thing I have to just say about Sting in the Cell. The premise when we first started that as well was to make it a radio-friendly album because it was really what we wanted to try and achieve, and we're all very happy with that album. We're very pleased with the way it came out, and I just hope that the listeners and the audience feel the same. And I thank you very much for your comments and your praise of it. Thank you.
Well, I do honestly enjoy it, and I can't wait till you guys are able to get here and play it live for us. That would be an amazing thing to see.
Well, you have to do same as us. We've got to get COVID under control, and then we might be able to do something.
Right. Well, in the meantime, stay healthy and happy, Rick, and keep working and writing. I want another album to come out soon.
Well, that's something in the pipeline. We're going to go back to do something like the first two TYA albums, the one called 10 Years After and the other one called Undead.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do things with one foot firmly in those blues fields.
Very good.
We've started kicking around ideas already.
Okay, well, we're going to leave right now with your version, the new band's version of I'd Love to Change the World, recorded just a few years back. And thank you again, Rick, for your time. I do appreciate you hanging on the phone with us so long.
Hey, come on. It's been my pleasure, Tom. I really enjoyed it. I hope to see you in the flesh one day.
I hope so. Stay healthy.
Thank you, and to you. And my love to all your listeners, and I really hope they enjoy what we're doing.
All right. Take care. My guest has been Rick Lee, founding member, drummer, author, guy that knows so much about so many. Read his book and listen to the tunes. Goodbye, everybody. Love this stuff. Tell me where is sanity. Tax the rich, feed the poor, till there are no rich no more. Well, I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. So I'll leave it up to you. Population keeps on breeding. Solution. Nations bleeding economy. Skies ain't sunny. Life is funny. Beasts make honey.